what I wanted. You're not what I had meant. You don't come close to the mark I'd set for the man I plan to find. We never left together. You've never seen me cry. We share but idle words, and I can't help but wonder why. And what will we do with the child that's got my hands, your hair, and my smile? Just for a little while. You never asked about a girl you never knew. She doesn't live here anymore. Think I'll forget about her too. Without you seems the only way. Time will pass, and then little he won't always be, and he'll ask about me then. And then what will you say to the child that's got my hands, your hair, and my smile? Just for a little while. La da 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 da.
That's pretty.
Thank you.
That's Jennifer. Oh. Yes, it is. And that's a record being knocked around. We wanted to do this a long time ago and have Jennifer here. And originally we were going to do it with some randy bearded type who shaved off his beard. But we don't have to do that now. Ricky Coon is here, and Jennifer, and if you...
Little Ricky Coon.
Little Ricky Coon.
Actually, when you get older, you want to be called Rick.
Well, no, I think I'd like to go back to Ricky. Okay. I think that's what the world needs, is more little kid-type names.
In that case, you can call me Ginny.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, we've gone over it. My nickname is Skip. I mean, it was my father's nickname.
Skipper.
Well, people do. But the one thing...
Skipper.
Yeah, I'm fine. Yes. The one thing that I didn't particularly care for, my name is Theodore, and I don't mind Ted, but I detest Teddy. And, after a while, people call you Teddy, and my first instinct is to remove their teeth forcibly with my fist.
Well, that's no way for a teddy.
That's right, but I'm not a teddy.
I see.
You see? So
it's very funny because my father's name was Theodore.
What?
They called him Ted, and he didn't like to be called Ted, and he got called Skipper. Not
really?
Skip, Skipper. Like captain of the ship, right?
Yeah, well, they called me Little Skip, except I got to be about 7 inches taller than my dad. And they didn't know what the heck, because they couldn't call him Little Skip. After I got bigger, you don't say that to my old man. But anyhow.
What's in a name?
What's in a name? Rick Kuna. and Jennifer Warren. And, you know, actually, she's billed as Jennifer because even though that's your real full name, Jennifer Warren, somebody got into what?
That's so ridiculous because you live with a name and it becomes your name and it becomes your, you know, it's like a, you know, a dress you wear or whatever. It becomes, you know, your personality or whatever. And then all of a sudden, there's such a thing as unions.
Yeah.
And unions say, who gets it first gets to keep it.
That's right. And it doesn't matter if it's your real name and it isn't theirs.
For a while, you know, I thought about, well, maybe if I change it. But I wasn't marrying anybody.
At the moment.
So I just said, well, then my friends call me Jennifer, and I hope it's not pretentious sounding. And as it turns out, people said, well, what is this, a Lulu? Or, you know,
Thank goodness, no.
So I kind of feel funny about being called Jennifer because it's not, you know, maybe it's not, doesn't seem right. I don't know.
I bet you did DJ interviews when your first record came out, and the first thing that the DJ said, right, was, do you remember everything? Right? Right.
I had nothing to do with that.
Yeah, no, Jennifer Warren, Jennifer, is at the Troubadour, and so is Rick. And they're there tonight, and you're excused. You can now turn off your set. Revox will forgive you. Rectilinear Research will forgive you. And I will forgive you if you pick yourselves up at this very minute, right? Because we have all this on tape, and if you don't think we're going to be playing it again, you're mistaken. So naturally, since you listen to the program every night, all of you, right? Right. Wherever you are, Santa Paula, Redlands, Goleta, old Blessed Soulet, leave what you're doing. Never mind the dishes. They'll hold until the morning. It's Sunday tomorrow, right? Get in a car and go down to the Troubadour, beat on the doors, beat on Doug Weston, right? And say, I want to get in. I must see these people. I want to see Jennifer. And now. That's all. Turn off.
If you talk like that, they'll let you in because Doug Weston is German.
Is he German?
Of course.
I didn't know he was German.
And so am I.
Ach so.
Yes.
Jawohl. It's very good, yes. Sit at attention, please. We have a dossier on you.
Well, I'm not, and I'm getting nervous.
All right. We'll get one on you. He's got to be some kind of pink commie, Hawaiian. Mixed.
They're
all mixed over there. You can't trust them. They're all mongrels. Right?
I have to agree with you.
Yeah. Thank goodness. That's. I think every time I see one of those commercial travelogue things on Hawaii, the really interesting thing is the mix. The people mix.
Yeah.
It tastes so good. Here are people who have somehow, you know, I'm sure there are rough spots and what have you, but somehow learned to get along as neighbors, right?
Yeah.
And they're so beautifully mixed up, you know,
yeah.
That what are you going to do?
Yeah, well, the one thing is that nature commands that place, that island, those islands. And really, it's I imagine, I've never been there, but I imagine it's quite easy to get along with other people in a way. Because really the most important thing is the ocean and the sky and the beautiful greenery. Here we have to travel a bit to get to some, you know. Some
try New York.
Well, let's not try New York.
Right.
I try it as little as I can.
All right, now look, now at the Troubadour, Jennifer and Rick are going to be there until tomorrow night. Sunday night is my favorite night at the Troubadour.
Yeah,
it's mine too.
Right.
Yeah, it's the most relaxed night.
Good to feel
it. It's the night that everybody else who does something comes up on stage and does something, right? So, you know, if Lightfoot's in town or Buffy St. Marie or whatever and somebody's on stage that they dig, right?
Yeah.
Vop, they get up and they do something either together or they do a guest set. Mm-hmm. It's the happening night if you want to. I hate that word because it implies such a lack of discipline. But it's really the grooviest night at the Troub.
Yeah.
And
Red Skelton will be there or something.
Yes, he'll get up and sing a silent song, right? He can do it, too. You know how he got his start?
I could guess.
No, I don't.
You know that picture? They shoot horses, don't they?
Yes.
Leo Seltzer, who later on formed the Roller Derby.
What?
The Roller Derby. And who's a very nice man,
actually. I didn't know
anybody
formed the Roller Derby.
He invented it. And I worked for him for a while. I did a kid show on TV back in the early 50s. You know, which he backed and what have you. And a very nice, complex man. Anyhow, he used to run some of those dance marathons back in the 30s. And Red Skelton, I think, was out of St. Louis. Or at least that's where he ran into the Roller Derby. And into the dance marathon thing. And what he used to do is get up there and entertain people for hours. And the way he did it is the way just about every comic starts. He went to see every comic in burlesque, every comic in vaudeville, and he'd pick their routines up, you know, whole hog, and then he'd do them, you know, with this incredible memory and what have you, except that he'd do them funnier than the people, you know, that he copied. And he had to cover hours and hours and hours of time because he was the only entertainment. And this is how he got his start.
Who is the fellow who?
Leo Seltzer. A man named Leo Seltzer. I don't know if he's...
Master at pitting people against people.
Yeah, and the funny thing is
he should have been around in the old Coliseum days of the adjusting days.
Oh, he would have done very well. But he's a nice man, strangely enough.
Yeah.
Listen, history... Let's give them a sample.
Yeah.
Of what we're going to do, together or one or what?
Well,
Tom Thumb's Blues. I could do that.
I would sort of like to do something with you. Let's do. I have a tune that I just heard last week. It's been at least 10 days, but. I heard it, and I had sung it when I was 5. My mother didn't have anything to do when I was 5, and so she brought me up on Hank Williams on a 78 record player.
Isn't that too bad?
And, the first tune I ever learned, we laugh about it. She went to the Troubadour last night, and we laughed because I told the story, and she said, "Yeah, that is true, isn't it?" But there's a line in Hank Williams' Cold, Cold Heart that goes, "Why don't you free your doubtful mind and melt your cold, cold heart?" And at 5 years old, I don't think I really understood what it meant. And that, along with another tune by Patti Page, were like the first tunes I ever learned, with the meaning explained to me so I could sing it with feeling. You know, that was her. She would teach me, visual things to do, like I pointing to your eye, love holding your heart, so anyhow, I heard this tune and it just brought back so many memories for me. I couldn't detach myself from the tune, and at the time, I suppose I thought Patti Page was the end, and so. I'd like to do that song.
All right, now you're going to do it with Rick?
Yeah.
Okay, we'll move you over. Zerp. All right.
You just point when it's for real.
You're in business.
I was waltzing with my darling to the Tennessee waltz when an old friend I happened to see. Introduced her to my loved one, and while they were waltzing, my friend stole my sweetheart from me. I remember the night in the Tennessee waltz. Now I know much I have lost. Yes, I lost my little darling the night they were playing the beautiful Tennessee Waltz. I remember the night in the Tennessee Waltz. Now I know I have lost. Yes, I lost my little darling the night they were playing the beautiful Tennessee.
Ain't that a nice, oh, what a nice song. Where did you ever find an original like that?
There's just no way of keeping some of those new songs down.
No, that's true, Rick.
And they did them the way they did them back then, sometimes because they didn't know any better, you know.
Do it just about that line of Rick Shayla, Lover, Romance, whatever it is. Just the chorus.
Just
the chorus. Whatever it is.
Okay.
Yeah,
this
why not?
A study in alienation.
Spontaneity.
Yeah, okay.
And baby, I don't want a rickshaw romance. I don't want a rickshaw love. If you're careless with your kisses, why turtle dove? I can't live on rickshaw romance. No, no, not me. If you're gonna rickshaw, baby, I'm gonna set you free.
Blues.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. What you doing over there? What kind of songs?
It's a combination of all these different kinds of people that inspire me.
Like whom?
Like Chuck Brell, for instance.
Uh huh.
And we do the thing from Tommy's the rock opera by The Who.
Oh yeah, we want to hear that.
Yeah, it's impossible to do it here with one guitar. That's.
Oh, how many do you have behind you over there?
Four people.
Wow.
Jim Gordon on guitar and Pat Smith on bass, Mike Cannon on drums.
Big
Pat
Smith?
Me. Yeah. Jim Gordon on piano. And Clavietta, as a matter of fact, he plays Clavietta on
Same Jimmy Gordon plays drums.
No.
Different Jimmy Gordon.
Yeah.
A lot of Jimmy Gordons in this world.
Yeah, well.
They're all
Jim Gordon is such a fine, fine person. And we do some ragtime things and... And, well, as a matter of fact, I was, I open with two Rolling Stones tunes. I don't know, I have a thing about the Rolling Stones. I somehow don't hear them as the Rolling Stones. I somehow hear them sieved through all the electronic music in kind of as a, you know, in a kind of soft way, like their Lady Janes and their, you know, and their Backstreet Girls and things like that.
Is that a built-in filter that you have, or do you have to work at it?
It must be. It must be. Because
I have to work at it.
Yeah, I wish I had it.
It must be. I don't know. I hear them like that. So it just so happened I opened with two Stones tunes that Jack Nitzsche produced. Mm. And Jack Nitzsche was in the audience, and he heard them, and he said, hey, you understand that funny timing, too. You know, you understand that thing that we did with the... With the Stones, and he was pleased, so I was pleased.
Can you do that here? Does it need four pieces?
Oh, it needs a lot.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Most Stones things do, don't they? I remember the first time I saw Mick Jagger, I said, "Oh wow, you know, because he was so loose. Yeah. And I think it was the first TV appearance I'd ever done. He was on Hullabaloo or Shindig or one of those shows, you know. And he came on with that Mac the Knife kind of, you know, smiling evil kind of thing, and he used the mic stand as a very interesting prop. And
he's like a very big giant rubber band that kind of with a large mouth, and I don't know, I've never seen him work, so I don't have that prejudice.
I'll tell you, he was fascinating to watch. Of course, he was very young when he first came over, so he would flip in and out of this, you know, evil cat bit into little boy.
Yeah.
Which gave him a certain appeal. Now, I don't know if he still does it, because I haven't seen him work in a long time in person. But it was, you had the feeling that you were watching a very real performing personality emerging at that time, you know, because let's face it, it was a new group.
I think that Mick Jagger, one of the nicest things about Mick Jagger is he never fails his audience. I don't care what motivates him, but he may be, you know, I mean, of course he's an exhibition of sorts, but I understand that that they're not so god-awful caught up in their musicality that they leave an audience cold.
Well, you don't quit either, do you? Do you? No.
Well.
No, as a matter of fact, no. We've had, there are a couple of people that we've been associated with off and on over the years. There's a 16-year-old kid that some people sent to us. They sent us a tape, and this tape sat here, as tapes are wont to do, for a couple of months, I guess, before I got around to listening to it. Because I'm always afraid when somebody sends in a tape that's going to be dreadful.
Yeah.
And then what do you say to the people, right? You know. And they sent me a letter saying he was a poor kid and he needed encouragement, and they had like 7 brothers and sisters and they were very poor and et cetera. And he was blind. And very talented, and that he'd been listening to my show a lot, and he'd picked up a lot of my material and what have you. And so, you know, a nice couple in Connecticut, from Switzerland. So I sent in this kid on the hottest day of July, and I was broadcasting out of a little bit of a pie slice of a club, and they built me a sort of studio up by the roof, and they'd forgotten to air condition it. And oh boy, it was rough. I mean, really rough. The heat must have been 120, 25 up there, you know. And this kid came in, and oh boy, was he talented. So that was the start of about 25 hours we had with Jose Feliciano. And we ain't talking a hell of a lot these days. But back then.
Speaking of blind people,
I never said, you know, and all the time we did the show, I didn't see any reason to make any reference to the fact, it was a radio show, you know, what have you, that he was.
Yeah.
And he didn't, and I didn't. So a lot of people, you know, who went to see him at various clubs and what have you, after they'd heard him on the show, what's that got to do with it?
Yeah.
You know, but he will not quit.
No.
He will not quit. He'll try. He'll push every button. If the cheap button works, fine. He'll use it, you know, as long as the audience is going, and if they won't do that, he'll try everything else, including quality. Of course, that's a last resort. But he's got it.
Yeah, he does.
To go with. Bekele, same way. Yeah. Theo Bekele in his own way. He will not quit until he owns an audience. And I've seen you, the last gig at the Troubadour. And the Troubadour is a marvelous place, but it can get some very ultra-hip people, and they're very cool, you know.
Yes.
And they sit around and they say, all right, you know.
Oh, my.
Do me something, right?
I wonder if music people have forgotten how to feel. I hear so much intellectual identification with certain groups, and people say, yes, I really, really understand and like and support, you know, this, whoever it is, because, you know, he's really, really where it's at. And yet, there's no analysis. Audiences are not critical anymore as to whether a performer gets to them. I mean, they'll intellectually like them, but they won't really admit it whether he got to them or not. Being a woman, it gets, you know, it bothers me that an entertainer will walk on stage and do an hour and never move an audience to any emotion.
Well, I think there's one answer to that. And I've seen it happen again and again and again. Because in places like the Troubadour and the Blue Angel, now defunct in New York, and like the old Renaissance on the Strip, Benny Shapiro's place, where the accent mostly was on jazz. But you do attract a show business crowd, and you do get a lot of your peers, mm-hmm. and you get a lot of people who got that show me attitude, or, you know, mm-hmm. I couldn't care less attitude.
Well, that's not bad.
Until you really get into it yourself. If you get to the point where your concentration is total and you believe it, you're going to get the same response out of them, maybe even more than you get out of just a general audience, because once you've got them licked, you've got them all the way, and then they're screaming for you.
Yeah.
And I've seen it happen again and again
and again.
Yeah,
that's good. No, the Troubadour is the ultimate musical test.
You think so?
Yeah, I think so, because of course, L.A. is so definitely musically minded. And the people who come to the Troubadour, you know they're well-schooled. You know they pretty much came to see you because they're somewhat familiar with what you do, and they're going to see if you're doing it any better. That's good. Keeps you on your toes. That's good.
Mm.
And so if you do please them, it's nice. You know, I somehow feel like working in... Mason Williams and I just got off a tour since September of colleges and universities across the United States, and Rick went with us. And you know, each audience, of course, all of the United States is different. Each one. I mean, everyone has their own particular mentality and likes and dislikes. And I satisfy myself when I'm successful at the Troubadour because I realize that perhaps musically there are people who think like I do at the Troubadour.
Mm.
But when you're in Kentucky or wherever, you know, if you sing a tune that is like... If we sing Cajun Drain, for instance, and they like it, that's all they like. And so you're happy for Cajun Drain, but you're not so happy for Jacques Brel's Old Folks or whatever. So I really get a very pleasurable experience to work at the Troubadour.
Well, I say, you know,
you can
know
spread out a lot.
You love Just Like Tom Thumb's Blues, and it's a very difficult song to sing well, and you do.
Well, I love Dylan.
But I watched... I watched a couple of shows last time you were there. I don't know, we got two or three maybe. And on one show, it didn't work.
Right.
The song just hung out there, and it's a long song, right?
Well, you see, that's the... That's
and it actually, you know, I'll say it bluntly, if it doesn't work, it's always a performer's fault. Your mind subconsciously had to be somewhere else. You had to be worrying about something other than just simply doing an acting job.
But you
on the lyrics.
Well, you realize, Skip, that there's a problem in being a performer that works off whatever's happening. In other words, I get down a song or a show or whatever. In my music, I know where the notes are, and I know where the tempo was supposed to be, and I know, you know, ahead of time. But that's all I know. And when the song starts, when a tune begins, if there's someone in the audience that you want to sing for, the tune will come out, you know. But if just before you went on, you know, and somebody said something rotten and you don't, you know, then the song is going to be bad. But I'd rather wait and hope that it's good, 75% of the time, hopefully. I'd rather do it like that. Then get my phrasing down so pat that I can duplicate it every time. Because if I do duplicate it every time, then my progress comes so slowly, you know. Or any, you know, like your awareness comes so slowly because you're telling yourself, now I'm going to step here and step here and step here because it works.
Well, the point I wanted
and you
to
never,
make...
You know, your discoveries don't come as fast.
The point I wanted to make was that it is very hard to recover, for a performer to recover, when they do a long number, especially, and I think you did it as an opener, or was very close to the opening in that particular set. A set has its own dynamics,
mm-hmm.
and each set has its own dynamics.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that very good performers know least is what to use, and how to pace, and how to program themselves. People who, you know, who are great on any individual number will just program wrong mm-hmm. so that when you have something that is as vital to your set as that song is, because mm-hmm. that has got to be the most important thing you do, during the sets that I was you threw yourself into it, etc., etc. So it didn't work this time. The point is, you did come back. It took two numbers to do it. Mm-hmm. But you did come back, and you had the audience womping and yomping and hollering and yelling, you know, which is great, you know. And I think Cajun Train came in there someplace, and it did help.
Yeah.
Yeah, because that's a sharing.
Yeah, placement is very important.
Yeah.
But you realize, too, that a set, you know, I mean, a set of tunes that follow, that, you know, you can get very, very bored by that.
Oh, boy.
And musicians and singers and whatever. I find myself getting right into the middle of the tune, and I say to myself, oh, my God, why am I singing something else? Mm-hmm. Because you die for inspiration. I get bored so quickly and so easily, I almost need a new tune every day. Because actually, when someone asks me to sing something that I did years and years ago that the boys don't even know, and we fake it, it usually turns out to have more feeling and more interest and more care than the tune I've been doing 10 times over. And I don't know how other performers can sing their hit, you know, whatever it is, again and again and again, and continue to move people again and again. Because as far as I'm concerned, I can't duplicate. It's like, even with friends, I can't discuss the same thing.
Over and over and over.
No, you've got to constantly find. I don't know. It's a difficult thing.
Well,
and I have people come and they say, well, did you enjoy that set? I said no. I said, look like it. You know, there's nothing I can hide, because if I'm bored by it, it's no way to pick it up in the middle of a tune. No way.
I can give you a hint.
What? Give me a hint.
I had that experience. I had a hit record and had to perform it hundreds of times. And I wince when I hear it now, that I stopped performing it a long time ago. But not only did we perform it hundreds of times, but we rehearsed it for 6 months before we ever put it on wax, daily, to get it down.
That's killing.
And the rehearsal was killing, but the thing that helped me renew the experience each time was to realize that, this is going to sound corny, but it's really true, those people came in there and paid their tab at the door, right there, whatever the number is to get inside the door and then to buy their drink, and the cat is spending his week's allowance or whatever to bring his girl along, you know, and to see you do
that too,
your thing, and you cannot let them down.
Oh, I realize.
If you can really look out past those lights and see their faces.
Well, I
can. And enjoy you. Yes, you can. Sure can.
No, I can. I see
well,
very
pretend.
Badly.
You're an actress. You know,
yeah.
You can feel it. Feedback from the audience. You get feedback from the audience.
You get a kind of wavelength, yes.
Sure, you know, and there's that buzzing thing that happens when it's really
but
clicking.
Faces don't hit me.
Well, but you'll get the feeling, and you make them so happy that you must have some gratification from that, and it does help.
Yeah.
Well, I know how hard it is to do the same song night after night, you know,
yeah.
In the same way.
I hear, for instance, eight performances a week, you know, singing the same tunes and saying the same words. You want to climb the walls,
mm-hmm.
because you say, oh, but there's another feeling inside me, please, you know. There's another experience that I'd love to share right here and now in place of the old one. And it's very difficult. But then on the other hand, there's a secret there. There were 25 people in the cast
mm-hmm.
who had different moods and different feelings every night. And if you watch them, and if you work with them, then the tune, you can get some sort of inspiration because you're singing for your friends. And that's the good thing about having Rick and having my friends on stage with me, is their, you know, their moods are different too. And it's conversations between voices and guitars and pianos that make the song go. It's not always the same because people are in different moods and whatnot.
You can also incorporate, you know, you don't. You can incorporate your mood into the song, And if you feel like doing it down, do it down. It'll be real, and the audience will know it's real.
Oh, yeah.
My first criterion and my last one is, do I believe him or her? Do I believe him? And usually it means, you know, do they believe themselves?
Yeah.
If you can find another pack of cigarettes someplace pretty late. For me, yeah. I cannot smoke those things with filters. I hurt my soul. You know, we've run out of a whole thing of tape, and we've been talking, and it's, you know, actually, look, we have lots of opportunity. But here's a working singer that I have said, you know, I don't have to embarrass you here, but I've said I think that Jennifer's going to be a huge star, you know, big show business figure for years and years to come. And she's going to have to work places like the Persian Room in New York and big places in Vegas. You looking forward to that?
Mm-hmm.
but it's true.
You talked to me about being a star, and I want to go home and have babies instead.
Well, it's a rough life being a star.
No, I'm let's say getting a little bit of bad taste in my mouth about the whole thing, and finally kind of discovering that there's one thing that anyone who creates anything has in common, even if they're not on stage and even if they're not renowned or what, and that is they got to get it out. And I would say that a man who has music for his life has a dedication and a sacrifice to me. But really, a woman can create in so many ways that if it ever gets you down, you're not addicted to it. If people begin to take over your lives, a woman can kind of say, well, I have, still a couple of other things to create, like children and homes and people. And so it's like an out. You know, I do a lot of, after a performance, I say, oh, well, boy, I can go home and cook now. To ever have it become that the only one and only force in your life is dangerous, especially for me.
Well, I found one thing is true, and we were talking about this before we started the tape. I saw it first with actresses because I, you know, was involved with theater. That was the first direct involvement on my part with the business, because my father was in it before and what have you, and I was around it, but I wasn't, you know, active in it. And there's a particular kind of actress. They're usually talented, but not that talented. Kim Stanley, they're not. Kim Darby, they're not. Who are going to make it. Everything they do, everything they think, everybody they use, and they use, is aimed toward one goal. They are going to make it.
Oh, well, that's...
And I find these the most... I don't care how pretty they are. I don't care how feminine they can act on stage. They're not women. They are not women. They're actresses, and that's all.
Well, you have to realize that women's place in society or anything else is she's considered a decoration, really. A decoration to whatever. And so you're taken a little bit more lightly than you hope. And actually that's really, really nice, because if you're taken seriously, you know, then you have to get this kind of mania for your work. I think all I really hope is that when I go home and sit down and sing to myself, that I like it as well. Because when you become someone else in front of other people, that's the way off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you understand a lot, considering how long have you been doing this?
Oh, don't ask. Too long.
Okay. but how long can a girl in her early 20s have been in the business? My wife started singing professionally when she was 14, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, by the time she was 19, she was a veteran. 5 years in the business, you're a veteran or else.
Yeah.
And she did it under conditions that are not necessarily duplicated today for people, you know, with talent. And... essentially, you know, I think she enjoys being a girl more than she enjoys being a singer, and she enjoys both a lot.
Yeah.
And she also says she'd much rather be a girl than a guy anytime, which is nice. She ain't here to talk to herself. Well, you know, it's true. She says it's a lot easier to be a girl in this world. Maybe it is, but the point is, the one thing you both have in common is some music, and we better make some.
Okay. What'll it be? We could do Cajun Train.
Cajun Train? Okay. Way to shift.
This is a song Rick wrote. I like to think he wrote it for me.
Well, I told you I did.
Yeah, shit.
There's a little girl sitting on the Mississippi riverbank, talking to a catfish that used to know her paw. Talking about the good times living in the bed. Talking about the papa that the girl never had. That was Louisiana on a summer Sunday morning. Gonna be that little girl one more time. Cajun train, take me home again. Ain't seen the muddy river since I don't know when. Rail ties ticking like an old clock, ticking up time to go back home, home. Home to me used to be Louisiana shantytown. I listened to the fiddle and the Jew's harp ring, singing about the good times living in the bed. Louisiana love song never make you sad. That was Louisiana on a summer Sunday morning. Gonna be that little girl one more time. Cajun train, take me home again. Ain't seen the muddy river since I don't know when. Rail ties clicking like an old clock, ticking out time to go back home. Since my childhood, river times, living in the city with a family to raise. Tell them about the good times living in the bed. Louisiana story makes a kid feel glad. Just like a lot of folks living on memories, living for the times that we'll never see again. Cajun train, take me home again. Ain't seen the muddy river since I don't know when. Real time's clicking like an old clock, ticking out time to go back home. Train, take me home again. Ain't seen the muddy river since I don't know when. Real time's clicking like an old clock, ticking out time to go back home.
Hell yeah.
Sure do miss the band, don't you?
Yeah.
We have one of the three of the finest musicians working with us.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we mentioned it before.
We've got We've got a fiddle player that travels with us, and and too bad he can't play the troubadour gig, but he's just fine.
Oh, you're talking about Billy Cunningham?
Bill Cunningham.
Yeah, well, we saw you with him last time.
Yeah.
Yeah. He plays fiddle, dobro, what else?
Barbed wire fence.
Uh-huh. Musical saw.
Yeah.
Fillings in his teeth.
Yeah.
Right.
And it's, all these people don't approach music from any one direction. You know, like no one gets into it for any specific reason. It's just, it happens to feel good.
Just a bunch of willow trees.
And you approach it from a technical aspect, and you approach it from feeling. And they're all just good, straight ahead people that don't.
You have fun up there, right?
Sure do.
Oh, yeah.
How about rehearsals?
Oh, rehearsals. We went on the tour. We rode a bus all over the United States, and that bus just. It swayed from side to side in tempo with the music.
Really?
Yeah, they're good guys. Really good.
Yeah. How much did Mace turn in?
Mason?
Yeah.
Mason's not a jammer.
I didn't think so.
No.
No. Yeah.
But that's good, I think. Because that keeps... Mason's got a very specific place in this world. And
a unique one.
Yeah.
Yeah, you'll hear that unique place, incidentally, on Tuesday night, friends, when Uncle Mace comes back around this way.
Well, great. I think Mason is the last outpost of grandeur in America today.
Oh, I like the Grand Tetons myself.
Well, in that humanistic sense, because he makes everything important.
Well, he makes some important things important that a lot of people forget. Mace has a great deal of talent Remembering the obvious, which everybody forgets and takes for granted.
He says it like everybody's thinking, but wouldn't dare say.
Well, this is, sometimes isn't a question of wouldn't dare. I get mad sometimes reading his books, because he's written down things that have crossed my mind, you know, like while I was in transit or in the course of things, all kinds of odd kind of things and observations and what have you, that are private, and, you know, they go zip, 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 zip past, and you retain them.
Yeah.
But it's a transitory thing. Mace, with this... he's his own Boswell, right? He sits down and he writes down what he thinks, right? And the observations that we all make, or some of us anyhow, make about people, life, the world, what's going on and what have you, including the rather rude ones and the funny ones, right? The things strike you funny and you can't say something about it because you're going to hurt somebody, right? Or they're not going to understand. So you just you chuckle inside to yourself and you keep a straight face, right? Or if you do have to say something, you do it in a deadpan throwaway line and it usually goes right past them, and that's okay, right? But Mace just simply sits down and he writes them.
Oh,
and there they are.
Oh, this is the cutest puppy.
Yeah, that's Ubba Gubba Zubby.
Oh, I love this puppy.
He's just a love bug. Stray dog, just like a lot of other strays.
Like a lot of us here.
Yeah, I'm going to switch tapes. Just a second.